I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's our international briefing. In a few minutes, Pakistan. The Bush administration considers the country a key ally in the war on terror, but does the U.S. need a new relationship with that country? The author of a new book about the Pakistani army gives his take. The army is one of the country's most important institutions. But first, Sudan and the International Criminal Court. Its chief prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, charged Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir with committing genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity in Darfur. Moreno Ocampo requested a warrant for al-Bashir's arrest. President al-Bashir's government says it will consider any attempt to arrest him an act of war. Joining us to talk about this is Stephen Rapp. He is prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. Prior to that, he served as chief of prosecutions at the UN International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Welcome. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Very good to be here, Michelle.
First, can I ask you, what is the logic of issuing this arrest warrant when it is very clear that the country will not comply? It's very clear that the surrounding countries are not going to intervene to force him to comply. What would be the logic of proceeding with this?
Well, the logic is that this case is referred to Ocampo by the United Nations, by the Security Council, with the support and or at least the non-veto of all of the permanent five members and a clear majority. It's the responsibility of the prosecutor to investigate, to find the evidence, and to go after, with that evidence, of arrest warrants and indictments for those that bear the greatest responsibility. That's the purpose of the court. Now, the question of will it happen? That's an interesting one. But in the case of our court, the indictment of Charles Taylor was handed down and became public in June of 2003. He was the sitting president of Liberia. Nobody thought he would ever come into custody. In May of 1999, Milosevic was the president of Yugoslavia during the period of the ethnic cleansing there. And no one thought there was any way that Milosevic, sitting in power and with an army around him, would ever come to justice. And within barely 2 years, he was being helicoptered into The Hague and into the detention center.
Well, I take your point that it establishes, if you want to call it that, sort of the moral orientation of the world community and the intention to seek accountability. But some are concerned that this will complicate, if not destroy, attempts to increase the presence of an international peacekeeping force. There were rallies in Khartoum earlier in the week. Some people say that these were sort of ginned up by the government, but it doesn't matter. People felt that they had to participate. Some people are worried that the safety of peacekeeping forces already there could be jeopardized. What do you say to that?
Well, in my view, at the end of the day, you don't have peace without justice. In the Sierra Leone conflict in 1999, just 6 months after the horrendous invasion of Freetown that saw the murder of thousands, the enslavement of thousands, amputation of hundreds of people, and rape and sexual violence on a broad scale, because of the power of the rebels in that case, an amnesty was given to them, and a peace agreement was signed, and all was allegedly forgiven, but within a few months, the perpetrators were back out committing the crimes. The peacekeepers themselves were being arrested and detained and killed by those that had not faced justice, and eventually it was necessary to have a court and to go after those that with responsibility. Frankly, our experience has been that being tough about justice, tough about atrocities, actually hastens the day when the perpetrators lose power and when the crimes end. It would be like if we were fighting the mafia or bank robbers or people who were committing horrible crimes, if, you know, we just basically said, oh, we've got to deal with you guys. We've got to give you power. We've got to move you into the city hall. We've got to do a variety of things. And then there would be an end to the rule of law, and there'd be no ability to protect our homes, our families, and everything else.
One of the critics is former U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Andrew Natsios. In an article on the website of the Social Science Research Council titled "A Disaster in the Making," he says this indictment may shut off the last remaining hope for a peaceful settlement for the country. The argument here is that, however worthy a decision this is in terms of seeking ultimate justice, the reality for the people on the ground is that their conditions may well be made worse. And if that is the case, how can it hasten a peaceful settlement if the initial consequence may be to make the conditions of the people on whose behalf you are seeking justice are made worse?
Well, first of all, let's keep in mind, and I want to point out again, this is not my case. It's not my court, even though we're trying the Taylor case at the venue of the ICC. I represent the Special Court for Sierra Leone. I'm familiar with the case to some extent. But there are in the ICC statute certainly a number of safeguards here. The arrest warrant has not been issued yet. It's 2 or 3 months away. There's the provision that the Security Council can, under certain circumstances, defer execution of the warrant and progress on the case on an annual basis. Other things that can be potentially done in this case to try to deal with immediate needs. But of course, in any kind of difficult situation in the world, I mean, you could imagine making compromises with a Hitler or someone like that, and indeed it eventually leading to greater suffering. And sometimes you have to take action, and particularly where you have a situation like Sudan where the government's been so uncooperative, where only 40% of the UN forces have been allowed to get in there, the equipment, the materiel, other things has been blocked, the ability to put in the sort of armored personnel carriers and helicopters is not something the government wants to see. It's sort of like, you know, no more Mr. Nice Guy if you indict me. And the fact is it hasn't been a nice guy. It's been the continuation of the atrocities against these three ethnic groups, according to the evidence cited by Prosecutor Ocampo in his application for an arrest warrant on Monday.
Finally, if we could just take 1 minute to get an update on the trial that you are heading. The last time we spoke, we talked about the trial of Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia. Could you just tell us how that is going?
Well, it's going very well. We began prosecution evidence in January. We're now in the 5th month of the presentation of evidence. 35th witness is on the stand this week. We're looking for it to be concluded within the next year, by a year from now. It is a complicated case because it involves tying him to crimes that were committed not in Liberia but in Sierra Leone, but very serious crimes, rape and murder and mutilation and pillage and the use of child soldiers. And enslavement to dig diamonds. It is a case that turns on the presentation of insiders. Most recently, I led the testimony of Taylor's vice president, his successor, Moses Blah, who testified against him. But we've had people from throughout the Taylor organization and from the rebels that have been testifying to the ways in which he assisted and in some cases ordered and instigated their actions. But of course, each of those witnesses are cross-examined by a very able defense team. They'll have their day in court, certainly by the first of next year, for them to present evidence, and then it'll be in the hands of the judges. But we think this case is proceeding as in a way that'll be a model for other cases before the ICC on how you can go after a person who's a former chief of state and have a trial that's open and fair and expeditious.
Stephen Rapp is the prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. He joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Very good to be here.
We're going to continue our conversation about the International Criminal Court's prosecutor's decision to charge Sudanese President al-Bashir with war crimes in Darfur. We're joined by Nick Grono, deputy president of the International Crisis Group. He joins us from Brussels. Welcome. Thanks for speaking with us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me on your program.
First, what's your take on the decision to go forward to seek an arrest warrant?
Well, it's a momentous application. I mean, this is the first time that the International Criminal Court has brought charges against a head of state, and it's the first time it's charged genocide. So on the international justice front, it's a very significant development. But of course, we also
have... Why is it the first time that genocide specifically has been charged? Is it that the concept was not well developed as a concept of law? Because I think certainly people understand what that is.
No, yeah, it's not an issue with the concept. It's the prosecutor is following the evidence. And genocide can be a very difficult charge to make, and obviously it's a very serious charge, and the prosecutor clearly believes he has the evidence to make that charge, and that's why he's proceeding with this first charge of genocide and his first charge against a head of state.
One gets the sense that the human rights and aid community is unusually divided over this. On the one hand, that people are applauding the decision to intervene against a world leader who seems determined to act with impunity. On the other hand, I think that people have been unusually vocal about concern about the safety of aid workers. Do you get that sense that there's unusual division over this, and why might that be?
Yeah, you're precisely right. And I think the division, I mean, everyone has a common goal of wanting to end human suffering, and there are very different views on how best to achieve that. The human rights community says we can best achieve that by ending impunity, which may end the kind of atrocities in Sudan, but also serves as a lesson for other conflicts or other potential perpetrators. The aid community, on the other hand, and those working on conflict prevention say we have an ongoing conflict. And unfortunately, to end ongoing conflicts, you often have to do deals with alleged perpetrators. And by prosecuting them, you make it much more difficult to actually reach a peace agreement. And so there is a division over how best to achieve a common goal, as I said, of ending suffering.
You wrote a recent op-ed piece published in the Boston Globe about this, and you pointed out that the how significant this is historically, but you also expressed concern that the indictment may lead to the regime to lash out. Weighing those two, do you think it was the right decision?
Well, I think it's definitely the right decision for the prosecutor. His job is to pursue the evidence and to pursue his justice mandate. But as your previous speaker pointed out, it doesn't end there. The UN Security Council also has the option of putting these prosecutions on hold. And the Security Council has a peace and security mandate. And what we've been strongly arguing is that there are risks for peace, but there are also opportunities. And the leverage that this provides should be used to encourage the regime to move towards peace. It's abjectly failed in the past few years to do so. But now that there's a threat of prosecution, one can use that to encourage the regime to pursue steps that will end the suffering and will bring a peace agreement about.
We're going to pause here for just a minute, and when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Nick Rono about the International Criminal Court's decision to charge Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir with genocide in Darfur. We hope you'll stay with us. Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're continuing our conversation with Nick Grono, Deputy President of the International Crisis Group, about the decision by Prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo from the International Criminal Court to charge Sudanese President al-Bashir with genocide in Darfur. In your op-ed, you wrote about the concern about the eventual eruption of wider regional tensions. What are some of the places you're concerned about and why?
Well, much of Sudan has experienced conflict in recent years, and so we're concerned that the regime may react in ways that exacerbates the ongoing conflict or causes new outbreaks of conflict. I mean, Darfur obviously is still an extremely violent and dangerous place, and peacekeepers were killed last week, a peacekeeper that was killed there yesterday. And there are other regions in Sudan that are extremely fragile. In the center, where many of the oil fields are, a place called Abyei, there's been a lot of conflict in recent times. And so it's a very unstable place. And what we think will be going on is that the regime will be calculating how it plans to respond to the threat of this indictment. And it has the options of either ratcheting up the violence or pursuing a course of action that promotes peace.
Why would it? I mean, one of the points that Stephen Rapp made is that this regime has shown no interest in world opinion.
Yeah.
So why would it change its tune?
Well, it would change its tune because there's now the threat of a prosecution against its president, which might not involve his immediate arrest and bringing before the court, but it's a prosecution that will remain on foot unless it's suspended. It also signals a strengthening of perhaps of world opinion. You have to remember that this prosecution results from a referral by the UN Security Council to the prosecutor. And so, you know, one doesn't view a prosecution for genocide lightly, even if you're even if you have a history of disregarding international opinion on these issues.
You mentioned that the arrest warrant might take a couple of months to actually be issued. What steps do you think the international community should be undertaking in this period?
Well, I think there should be, and I think there probably is, frantic diplomatic activity going on behind the scenes. As I said, the option, if there's a prosecution, is for the UN Security Council to put any prosecution on hold. Now, it would be very difficult for states like the US and France and UK to put a charge of genocide on hold if Sudan is still undergoing violent conflict and the regime is doing nothing to promote peace. But if the regime demonstrates very concrete and credible moves towards promoting peace in the country, then it may be an option for the Security Council to put this on hold. And I think those discussions are going on right now. The Sudanese government is talking to friends and allies in the Africa Union and the Arab League and other members of the Security Council to explore those options.
We've talked about the role of the ICC and the government, but what do you think should be the role of international organizations at a time like this?
Well, I think you know, those that want to promote peace should use this as an opportunity to make it very clear that there has to be concrete steps towards peace. We haven't seen any of that over the last few years from the Sudanese government because it's pursued its own objectives. But as the cost for its flouting of international standards is increased, then there is more incentive for it to think about seriously about promoting peace. And I think the international community has a very strong role in promoting that that objective.
Given, though, the president's past behavior, doesn't he have a reasonable fear that he could still be prosecuted for past acts? And do you think it would be morally justifiable to, in exchange for stopping this behavior and working toward peace, that he were to be essentially given amnesty for that? Do you think that that's a justifiable course of action?
Well, the last point you raise is a very good one, and it's a very difficult question to answer, you know. And again, it's about what is our goal and what is our objective. And I think, as I said, most of us are aiming towards reducing human suffering. Now, if you have a conflict in Sudan that has resulted in the deaths of over 300,000 people and some millions displaced and living on international support, one has to talk about the moral considerations related to ending their suffering as well as the imperative to ensure international justice. And these are never straightforward. The case of Charles Taylor that was talked about earlier, the fact was that the indictment against him did weaken his position. But what also weakened his position was the US stationing a warship off the coast of Monrovia and Nigeria offering him asylum. And so he left the country, not because he was being prosecuted and threat of immediate arrest, but because he was offered an asylum deal. And then that deal later fell through and he was handed over to the court. But you got him out and you ended an extremely nasty conflict in Liberia through what might be a morally, you know, equivocal position. Another case in point might be that of Robert Mugabe, who fears arrest and, you know, has entrenched himself in power.
I see. We're going to have to leave it there. Nick Rono is Deputy President of the International Crisis Group. He joined us from Brussels. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now to Pakistan. Although Iraq and Afghanistan have been top foreign policy priorities for the U.S., Pakistan is a key regional player in the so-called war on terror. That's one reason Senator Barack Obama, the Democrats' presumptive presidential nominee, this week talked about changing the course of U.S. relations with Pakistan and the Pakistani people, saying the country has become a growing sanctuary for al-Qaeda.
Make no mistake, we can't succeed in Afghanistan or secure our homeland unless we change our Pakistan policy. We must expect more of the Pakistani government, but we also must offer more than a blank check to a general who has lost the confidence of his people. It's time to strengthen stability by standing up for the aspirations of the Pakistani people.
We wanted to look deeper into the forces behind the country's politics. To do that, we're joined today by Shuja Nawaz. He's a native of Pakistan, the author of Crossed Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
How significant is the army as an institution in the life of Pakistan?
It has had a huge impact on the history of Pakistan for well over 33 to 35 years, depending on how you count it. Pakistan has been under direct or indirect military rule in its 61 years of independence since 1947. We've had different martial laws and different military rulers, the most recent being General Musharraf.
I think it's hard for Americans sometimes to understand a country in which the army has an identity as an institution apart from civil society. I mean, in this country, the military is very explicitly under civilian control, and it's considered quite controversial when you put a person an active duty military person in charge of civilian, sort of what is perceived as kind of the civilian domain. Why is Pakistan's army so central to the governance of it? And is there any effort to change that in sort of the building of a civil society?
The first response to your final question, yes, mm-hmm. there is a tremendous effort, and the last year certainly has shown the rise of civil society and a desire to take back governance from a military dictator or autocrat on the one hand, as well as the dynastic parties that have been running Pakistan when the military hasn't been running it. The reason why the army became so critical in Pakistan's history was that Pakistan lives in a very tough neighborhood. It was born out of a partition of British India and almost immediately went into war with India over Kashmir. And the army was totally unprepared. And so the first reaction after that was to strengthen the military. And Pakistan turned everywhere to see where it could get assistance. And it didn't have much help, except when the United States wanted allies against the communists. Pakistan said, well, we're ready to fight the communists for you. We will protect the oil fields of Iran and Iraq. And you just tell us, and in the meantime, we need these weapons. And so you had this direct military relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan, which strengthened the military and ended up, an unintended consequence was it weakened the civil.
Who does tend to join the army? Does it tend to be a long history of family connection? Does the army recruit in the way that we understand it here?
Interestingly, Pakistan has a volunteer army and always has. And traditionally, many of them came from the north of Pakistan. But in the last couple of decades, there's been a tremendous shift. And I have data in my book which shows that now the army is much more evenly representative of all the provinces and all the cities. It's a much more urban recruitment, and it's a much more, as a result, conservative institution, because the urban cities, particularly inner cities, tend to be religiously conservative.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with author Shuja Nawaz about his new book, Crossed Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. I assume that some policymakers have the fear that al-Qaeda can infiltrate or has sought to infiltrate the Pakistani army as a vehicle to extend its reach and influence in the region. Is that a real fear? Is that a real possibility?
I don't think that's a real possibility. Al-Qaeda, when we talk about it as an entity, is basically non-Pakistanis who entered Afghanistan and then after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan managed to infiltrate into the badlands of the border, which are very difficult to police. But more and more, I think the Pakistan army now realizes that they have to provide security to the population and thereby isolate the insurgency. And once you've isolated the insurgency, you can then isolate especially the foreign fighters that are al-Qaeda, that are Arabs or that are Uzbeks or Chechens.
Now, obviously, we invited you to talk about your book, but I did want to get your take on the current presidential campaign and the way regional issues, especially Pakistan, are being talked about in the course of the campaign. We mentioned that earlier this week, Democratic presidential nominee, the presumptive nominee, talked about the importance of changing U.S. policy toward Pakistan, including vastly increasing non-military aid to the Pakistani people. But he also has said that he would consider some unilateral military action if it is proven that Pakistan has become a safe harbor for al-Qaeda. What is your take on that?
I think first on the change in policy stance, this is extremely important and useful, although it is something like 6 years too late. This should have been done at the very outset rather than simply going for a direct military-to-military relationship and sending money to Pakistan to reimburse the military for its actions. It was not simply a military approach, and I agree with Senator Obama that you now need a different approach. Because of the U.S.-Pakistan history in Afghanistan has been that the U.S. will depart, and it will depart suddenly, leaving a messy situation for Pakistan to handle, which is why they were hedging their bets on the Taliban. Well, now, of course, they realize that the battle has come into the hinterland in Pakistan and that it's critical for them to take it on, not just militarily, but economically and politically. And the longer the U.S. involvement And the longer the Western involvement with aid projects and support for Pakistan's efforts, the better it will be, I think, for Pakistan. And you eliminate the possibility of militants getting an upper hand.
The presumptive Republican nominee, John McCain, also talked about Pakistan this week in remarks at a town hall meeting in Albuquerque. He was critical of Senator Obama. He considered his remarks indicative of what he called his naivete about foreign affairs. I'm going to play a short clip.
We must convince the Pakistanis that this is their war as much as it is ours. And we must empower the new civilian government of Pakistan to defeat radicalism with greater support for development, health, and education. Senator Obama has spoken in public about taking unilateral military action in Pakistan. In trying to sound tough, he's made it harder for the people whose support we most need to provide it.
Your thoughts about his approach?
Well, obviously, when you're running in a campaign, you want to differentiate your message, even though you may be basically saying the same thing. Frankly, I don't see a great deal of difference between the two candidates on this front. The most important difference, though, is in Senator Obama's insistence that there should be a Pakistan policy. Up till now, much of what has happened in the relationship between the United States and Pakistan, and this has been a continuous theme in my book, and it's almost a cyclical sort of roller coaster relationship, the U.S. has gone in with a policy, a strategic policy, in which Pakistan tends to be a spin-off, one little cog in a much larger operation. Now I think they realize that you really need to focus on a Pakistan policy, and within that, you need to focus on a policy with the people of Pakistan, a relationship with the masses, not with an autocrat who could deliver instantly. You went to him and he said, okay, I'll move 100,000 troops. If you recall, when the United
States... Can you really do that, though? I mean, is it really possible for the U.S. at this point, given all of the that has transpired over the last 5 years, to renew its relationship with the Pakistani people apart from its leader?
Well, that leader doesn't have much power, or much less power than he did at one time. You now have a civilian government, and it represents the millions of people that voted it into power. If you recall, when there was an earthquake in 2005 in Pakistan, the United States went in voluntarily, did fantastic rehabilitation and relief work, and the opinion of the ordinary Pakistanis about the United States went up dramatically. But then the U.S. left and all that capital was wasted. It disappeared. I think a longer-term engagement and focus on social and economic development is likely to revive that relationship and a greater trust. At the moment, there is a trust deficit.
Living in a major city here as we do, you get the sense that there's a significant Pakistani expatriate community in the United States, in all occupations, you know, from the sort of basic retail and service providers and academics. And do those relationships help?
Absolutely. And in the past decade, particularly, the expatriate Pakistani community, which is roughly about 1 million+ in the United States, has become very active politically also. And they take a political stance and they affect United States policy.
And the Pakistanis in the U.S. tilt one way or the other politically?
A lot of them, particularly the first generation, tends always to go with the government because that's what they were used to at home. But with the younger crowd, particularly the children that were born here and that have now entered politics, increasingly I find a much more democratic leaning.
Very interesting. Finally, I wanted to ask you, is there something in particular that you would wish people to take from your book, or is there some perception about Pakistan that people have that you would most wish to correct?
One thing that my book helps people understand is that the United States-Pakistan relationship is not unlike many other U.S. relationships abroad. It has to be based on a long-term view and not short-term benefits for the United States. And that's quite critical because people in our part of the world particularly have very long memories. And the word for yesterday and tomorrow is the same word in Urdu, kal. And it's not bound by 24 hours. It can go for decades or centuries. And so people remember those things. And in terms of the support for democracy, the more the U.S. is seen as walking the walk and not just talking the talk in favor of democracy, the more I think the United States can be an influence on public opinion within the country.
Shisha Nawaz is the author of Crossed Swords, Pakistan, Its Army and the Wars Within. He was kind enough to join us here in our studio in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Still to come, why recycling is about more than just separating your bottles and cans. It can be something to believe in. Our essayist tells us why in just a few minutes. But first, we're observing Cheapskate Week. We're trying to offer practical ways to save some cash in these hard economic times. Today, we want to talk about food, how to save and still eat healthy. Fast food meals fill you up, but they also fill you out. But cooking healthy takes time and money. Here to help us see our way out of the mess, nutritionist Ravinia Brock, better known as Dr. Ro. She is the author of Dr. Ro's 10 Secrets to Living Healthy, and Jonelle Nash, the food editor at Essence Magazine, which features her article, Healthy Food Shopping for Less, in the August issue, now on the stands. Hi, ladies. Thanks for coming.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
So first of all, Dr. Ro, we're not making this up, are we? It really does seem that healthier food costs more, like options like organic and so forth. So, Dr. Rowe, why is that?
Well, you know, I think there's more that goes into organic farming of food, but I do want to say that it seems like it costs more. Healthy food does not have to cost more. Here's a case in point: beans and rice, beans and brown rice, by the way, not white rice. It's a perfectly sound and nutritious entree. You could have it as an entree or a side dish. But for pennies per serving, a great source of protein, plus you get the fiber and other nutrients that are needed. So we like to think that eating healthier is an expensive proposition, but it does not have to be with good planning.
And just briefly, if you just give me the 30 seconds on fast food. I mean, fast food is cheap. You get your $5, you go to the counter, you're full.
Yeah.
What's so terrible?
I'm not going to say there's things so terrible, because even in the fast food lane, it's possible to make healthier food choices. You could choose to have a small burger, a single burger that has not been fried, deep fried, by the way. You could choose to have that with, say, ketchup and mustard, as opposed to a mammoth counterpart with all the sauces, more cheese, more burgers, more calories. That said, there are many options that you can make that are healthier and better for you in the fast food lane. I particularly like the salads that are offered.
Now that we've talked a little bit about eating out, let's move to eating in. Jonelle, you make the point that if you want to eat well for less, seems like you got to get out those pots and pans. So what's the key to getting quality food at a reasonable price in the supermarket?
Well, generally, I think the bright side, though, of cutting back in an economic downturn is that, you know, the foods that are actually the healthiest and best for us are really also the best for our budgets, in that the vegetables, the fruits, the grains, the nuts, highly recommended by, you know, Dr. Ro, other nutritionists, is that they are the foundation of any good diet, and they're typically going to cost less than the red meats, which we tend to be advised to limit. But I think for success at the supermarket and in shopping, it really starts with some pre-planning. And you have to plan for a week's worth of menus. You create the menus, exactly what you'd like to have, basically, for at least 5 of the 7 days. And then from that, you grow a shopping list. And although it might seem like a lot of work, in the end, it's going to save time and it's going to save money. It's those multiple trips to the supermarket during the week that result in a lot of unplanned and wasteful spending. And when you have the time on the weekends, then that's when you do a little slow cooking and the larger quantities, so that during the week you can have these quick, healthy meals that are sort of spin-offs from what you prepared on the weekends, or fortunately on those days when you might get home early during the week.
I see your point. The more trips you're making at the supermarket, the more inclined you are to perhaps make impulse purchases, kind of shop off the list, just get excited about a special up front that you don't really need. What about organic, Jonelle? A lot of people are attracted to organic food for health reasons and for quality, but it does seem like it costs more. Are there ways you can cut the cost of getting organic food.
Oh, most definitely. The two ways that we sort of covered in our particular story, one is the farmers markets, and I think they are just such a boon, especially for many inner city residents where, you know, the corner convenience stores are selling more processed foods and, you know, sodas than actual fresh produce. So the fact that the farmers markets are now in so many urban areas are just a great shopping idea. And because you're buying direct from the farmer, and in a sense you've sort of cut out the middlemen as such, prices can be lower. And so you're getting perhaps, you know, excellent quality, freshly picked produce at considerable savings. And the other aspect to buying healthful foods at a very low price is from the food cooperatives, mm-hmm. which are growing very rapidly in city and outlying areas. And these are, of course, nonprofit organizations that are owned by the volunteers. And so they're able to buy food in bulk and, again, eliminate a lot of the middlemen, the cost of advertising. Mm-hmm. And so the food is also offset by the fact that the volunteers, the members of the co-op, are actually doing the work.
Let me just jump in right here just mm-hmm. for 1 second to say, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with writer Jonelle Nash and nutritionist Ravinia Brock, a.k.a. Dr. Rowe, about eating healthy on a budget. We want to hear from you, too. What are your tips for keeping the food bill down without resorting to the ramen noodles? You can call our comment line at 202-842-3522 or hit us on the Tell Me More page at NPR.org. You can comment on any aspect of escalating food prices and how to eat well on a budget. Dr. Rowe?
You know, I just wanted to pick up on something that Jonelle said earlier, Michelle, and that is the food co-ops in this economy of rising food costs and everything. It's a good idea if you live in an apartment building or a complex or something to get together with your neighbors and form your own co-op so that you can go either to grocery stores or go to other stores that sell food in bulk, buy it as a community, and then distribute it amongst your neighbors. And you could even sell it, you know, to people who live in your community. And you set it up either in a basement, in a rec room, at a church, or wherever it's convenient. But you could decide to do this with, say, five other neighbors that you're going to choose one day a month and go to do the bulk shopping for the community and save, you know, tremendously that way.
But I can hear some people saying, I don't have time for that. That all takes time. How do you manage the time that it takes to, because it does take time to shop carefully, to make that list, to prepare the food. And I can just imagine people saying, listen, I'm a single mom. I got, you know, two kids. I work full time. And when am I supposed to do that?
The time is going to pass anyway. You're going to have to do it. You're going to have to be doing something in that time. That's the point. You have to feed your family anyway. So we can't poo-poo it away with the whole notion that, you know, I'm so overwhelmed, I can't take the time. If you are joining a food co-op, for example, with your neighbors, the good news is that you can distribute the work. You see what I'm saying? So one person gathers the sales. One person takes responsibility for some aspect of that shopping. So in other words, it becomes, you know, a community affair, and it's not, the load of the work is not all on you.
Jonelle, what about some of the big box stores like Costco or Walmart that sell a lot of these, what do you call them, mega stores, Costco, Sam's Club, and mm-hmm. BJ's? You know, the prices seem great. What's your take on that?
Well, the prices are great. And you have to determine, though, if buying in gigantic sizes, if that's right for you and your family. There is a membership fee, and that might range up to about $50. But if you have a large family, or again, if you are sharing with other members of your family or in the community, then it could be very practical. The savings can be quite tremendous. The stores, they are, again, gigantic, and it does, in a sense, they can be rather time-consuming. But again, if you set the time aside, if you plan for it, again, there are definitely good bargains to be had in the mass stores.
Dr. Rowe, you were telling us earlier that there are some particular foods that offer significant nutritional punch for the dollar. Any other suggestions on
that point? You know, we talked about produce, and I can't say enough how important it is to get fresh fruits and vegetables in the diet, because the more you do, the better off you're able to stave chronic diseases, heart disease, hypertension, type 2 diabetes. If, in fact, it's about budget, as Jonelle said earlier, the planning, of course, is essential, but it doesn't mean that you cannot have, you know, fresh produce. In fact, you should. There are some cases where you could sort of back that up with frozen vegetables, even for convenience, canned fruit, and it's packed in its own juice. So you can have a combination of those things, but you definitely want to make sure that you have adequate vegetables and fruit in the diet. You want to make sure that you have adequate whole grains, so brown rice in place of white rice, whole grain pasta, and other grains that we don't normally use in our diet, like quinoa. Looks like quinoa, but pronounced quinoa, pearl barley. We want to have a number of those kinds of grains. And beans, for pennies a serving, you can have one of the best protein sources that is also high in fiber and a great complex carb at the same time.
I get the impression that you're saying, actually, maybe you should start your meal planning there. Start with the veggies,
yes,
the beans,
and
the
go
rice,
out from
and go out from there.
Out
a lot
from
of us
there.
Are used to thinking the other way. You know,
yeah,
start with the meat. You're saying, no, go the other way.
Go the other way. We're so accustomed to having this boring brown and beige American diet of meat and potatoes, which is the stuff that's put us in the position that we find ourselves today.
Jonelle, you have a couple of other great tips in your piece, and one that I liked was, look the ingredients. If you can't pronounce it, don't buy it. But finally, you said, eat with the seasons. Look for the fruits and vegetables that are in season. Why does that matter? Why is that important?
Oh, I think that's most important, in that when you're buying produce, when the produce, when it's really at its peak, at its height of availability and harvest, actually that's when the flavor is highest, the nutrition is highest, and actually the cost, the prices are lower. So it's just a very practical thing to do. And when we eat with the seasons, it really puts us just sort of in sync with nature. And it is, I think, in a sense, it just sort of touches us on a more soulful level.
And the food's pretty, too. The food is pretty. Yeah. All right, we have to leave it there. Writer Jonelle Nash's article, Healthy Food Shopping for Less, is published in Essence Magazine's August issue. It's on the stands now. She's food editor there, and she joined us in our New York Bureau. And Dr. Ravinia Brock, a nutritionist and author of Dr. Rose, 10 Secrets to Living Healthy, joined us in our Washington studio. And I have to tell you, she's looking fabulous and fit. And I'm kind of jealous right now, but thank you so much despite that fact.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Finally, Damali Ayo must have heard about our Cheapskate Week. She sent us an essay about how she went green and saved some green at the same time. Her story is the latest installment of the award-winning series, This I Believe. The revival of Edward R. Murrow's 1950s radio program has been hosted by National Public Radio since 2005. Here to tell you more is series curator, independent producer Jay Allison. Jay?
Thanks, Michelle. Here in America, as you know, we're often persuaded to believe that newness is a positive value in and of itself. Advertisers will brag that their products are disposable, that when we're done using them, we can throw them away. But Damali Ayo's experience led her to rethink that principle. Here she is with her essay for This I Believe.
Last summer, I looked out the door of my 100-year-old house at my newly planted garden and my adopted dog. I paused. I was overcome with appreciation. I realized nothing is trash. I started to look around me at all the things we ordinarily think of as trash. Discarded plastic bags, water from boiled pasta, pulled weeds, rubber bands and newspapers, busted up concrete, clothes and furniture we outgrow, and I began to think and act and live according to a belief that all things have a continued purpose in the world, if we just find it. I realize I believe in recycling. The kind of recycling I mean is not just the dividing up of glass and paper and cans and putting those in a bin to be hauled away, but the kind of recycling that requires creativity and commitment. Even love. In my neighborhood, everyone puts out their raked autumn leaves to be picked up by the city, out of sight, out of mind. This didn't fit with my newfound love of reintegrating trash into my life. So I mapped out a new garden with flattened moving boxes and put up a sign that said, "Dump your leaves here." I watched through the autumn as my neighbors piled their leaves on this new garden. I watered the leaves with collected rainwater and even composted some of Stevie's doggy do. Finally, I got topsoil from Craigslist. Now I have a new ornamental garden. My belief in recycling isn't trivial or novelty to me. The trash we make is often dumped in places populated by people of color. Every piece of trash I throw away, I can feel being thrown in the backyards of the people I care most about in this world. Nothing has to be discarded, really. If you try hard enough, everything can be reintegrated. I even use my bathwater to water my garden. Gross as it might seem to my friends, I see it as potential waiting to be filled, as future heads of lettuce, tomatoes, poppies, and lilies. This might seem like a big step, but if we can get down to watering our gardens with our bathwater, maybe we wouldn't be so afraid of admitting our flaws, mistakes, and failings. Maybe our discarded layers would be things to learn from and ultimately turn into something better. When I look at my dog, Stevie, I see one of the greatest joys of my life. But someone once saw her as something to be thrown away. She was abandoned and blind and found on her own in the woods. She's a wonderful dog, and when I look at her and remember what she's been through, I'm moved to tears. Maybe this is because I hope to be recycled one day, too. That someone will have the heart to see treasure in me, not just a past full of discarded relationships, but the potential for a new life, just like I do with all the things I recycle in my world. Just like those things, I sit in my metaphoric recycling bin, waiting for someone to pass by and say, "Hey, you're just what I've been looking for."
Damali Ayo with her essay for this, I believe. Ayo's now focused on her new enterprise. It's a sustainable fiber clothing company that also gives out resources on health and social justice. Michelle, as always, we invite Tell Me More listeners to contribute their thoughts to our series. All the information and all the essays are at npr.org. For this, I believe, I'm Jay Allison. Back to you, Michelle.
Thanks, Jay. Jay Allison is co-editor with Dan Gediman, John Gregory, and Vicki Merrick of the book This I Believe, The Personal Philosophies of Remarkable Men and Women. As Jay said, to find out about submitting your own This I Believe essay, visit npr.org/thisibelieve. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Let's talk more tomorrow.